Hey.
Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. Not even me. All right?
All right.
You got a dream, you got to protect it.
It's Innate, a podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton, and this is Innate. So, should I introduce our illustrious guest?
I got a little intro ready for her to go, you want me to take it away.
Great, then I'll let you do it. Yeah, no, I'll let you do it.
We are very excited to be hosting a guest today. Today we have Melis Muradolu, who is a fifth-year psychology PhD student in the Cognitive Development Lab at NYU, led by Dr. Andre Simpian. And much of her research examines achievement-related representations with a focus on how children and adults think about the sources of success. And her work has examined the content and development of children's reasoning about academic performance, as well as adults' attributions for their own professional successes. In other research, she studies how children form representations of social groups, as well as animal kinds. So welcome to the show, Melis.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. We're so excited to have you.
Yeah,
before we jump into anything more fun, do you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself? Other than the, real specific details of your introduction I just gave you.
Yeah, sure. I guess we can
just,
start with
where you're from, what brought you to the world of developmental psychology.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I am from Florida originally. I grew up in Central Florida. I was actually born in Istanbul, Turkey. My father is Turkish. My mother is American. They were living in Turkey for a period of time, and my sister and I were both born there. Long story short, Turkey was undergoing a recession the year I was born, and so they moved to Central Florida to be closer to my mother's parents. And so I grew up in Central Florida, in Lakeland, Florida. I went to elementary, middle, high school there.
And all the way from high school to where did you go for your undergrad? I don't think that we mentioned that.
So for undergrad, I went to the University of Florida. So it was pretty close to where I grew up. And at the University of Florida, I studied psychology and anthropology. How did I get into developmental psychology?
Well, before you answer that question, I actually have a question for you.
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the topic of the difference between psychology and anthropology came up.
Oh.
And I thought it was an interesting enough question. So I guess given that you've studied both, what would you say is the key difference between anthropology and psychology?
I'm going to be complete, I have no reference for that. So I would love to...
Yeah, me either. I mean, I guess you just
they must go
bones
well
and
together.
Shit, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Man, and what is my well-formed answer for what the difference is? I think to me both are interested in human behavior kind of
right.
Broadly. I think what kind of behavior differs a lot between anthropology and psychology. And I think, time scale differs considerably as well. But honestly, the thing at my mind, at the fore of my mind, when I think about the big differences between anthropology and psychology is, the methods they use for studying humans. That's, the huge difference to me. Anthropology research does a lot of ethnographic work, archaeological work, and things like that. And, psychologists do... what we do.
Who knows what we do?
I'm still trying to figure out what the hell it is I do.
Yeah.
Maybe this podcast will give you that opportunity to figure out what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your representation for the difference between them?
I don't know. I mean, so in that podcast, they mentioned pretty much the distinction that they sort of drew on was exactly what you just said. So one of the key differences is in the methods and also time scale. And they also had, during that discussion, they were talking about, they brought in sociology and what's the difference between psychology and sociology. And of course, there, the difference is really sort of level of analysis, right? So with psychology, the focus is really on the person and on understanding the behaviors and the mechanisms and stuff like that. Whereas with sociology, we're looking at societies. How do societies change? And anthropology, rather, is sort of, about, time scale differences.
So, like, would
But
you
again,
think
all three fields are roughly interested in people at some level.
like history mixed with sociology, maybe? Is that a very broad stroke possible-ish explanation? Melis is like, absolutely not,
For
I think
anthropology,
there's
you
that.
mean?
Yeah,
Say again.
I have no frame of reference for anthropology. I have my frame of reference is forensic anthropology, and that is coming from Bones, the TV show. So
Well, that's why I
that's
made the joke
about.
about Bones, because that's my reference point
That's
too. But surely
it.
that's overly
Yes,
simplistic,
I'm sure.
and your answer was clearly more sophisticated than my very pablum answer. So, but yeah, so I cut you off. You were getting ready to talk
He does
about
that
what got you into
sometimes.
developmental
He does that
psychology. Yes, I
sometimes.
do that
It's
a lot.
okay. We'll
No,
take tangents.
that's totally fine. What was I talking
So,
about?
Developmental
yeah,
psychology, how you
how?
got into it.
How I got into developmental psychology. So, research, I guess, specifically. So, my memory in undergrad is that working as a research assistant wasn't really at the fore of my undergraduate education, and I don't remember it being advertised super heavily in classes. I feel like at NYU, we constantly advertise to undergrads, like, come work in our lab, come work in these developmental labs. But I think what happened is that at some point I had a friend who was working, who was studying psychology, and he was working in an applied behavior analysis lab. And I was like, that seems like a fine thing to do. I guess it was the summer after my sophomore year, and I was like, okay, this could be I have more time now because I'm not going to take classes, and so maybe I'll try to work in a lab and see what that's about. And I applied to a lot of labs, some of which had openings and some of which didn't. And one lab that took me on as a research assistant that summer was an aging lab, actually. So my first foray into developmental research was in something pretty different than I do now, but it was in a developmental lab.
Yeah, that's really cool. Were you intrigued by aging and working with older adults?
Honestly, it wasn't really an interest of mine at the time. I just kind of applied broadly. And I remember there was a cognition lab, different lab that I really wanted to work in, I think, and they didn't end up having openings, and so I worked in this aging lab. But they seemed really eager to have research assistants, so I was excited to be in that lab.
Nice. And what was your role? I mean, you were a research assistant, but were you allowed to do studies, allowed to analyze data? What capacity did you serve in as well?
Actually, when I started working in that lab, I was kind of doing a mundane task. I was just entering data from an old study where all the data had been collected.
You were that helpful research assistant that I apologize to every semester, and I'm like, I'm really sorry, but somebody really just
But
needs.
here's a thousand, here's here here's this 2 gigabyte CSV file, but I'm really sorry.
It wasn't even a CSV file. It was paper.
Same.
Exactly. And I entered them into this program called REDCap or something like that. I don't
Oh
even.
God.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I would sit in this kind of, it was on the basement level. It was like a windowless RA room, and I was like entering data. But the cool thing about that is I felt like I was gradually given more responsibilities in that lab. So that first summer I was doing a lot of data entry, which was mundane. But eventually I got to do studies with older adults. And so there was like some progression and like some things to look forward to, like, oh, after I get this, you know, health clearance, I can work with the older adult.
You mean waking up every day and looking forward to going down to a windowless basement wasn't exciting enough?
It wasn't quite exciting enough, no.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, what kind of normal human are you to want excitement and novelty?
Yeah. And then you ended up then, you know, this taking this developmental research and then turning towards working with children. And that was, did that come when you were headed to graduate school?
Yeah. So what happened was maybe around a year later, the summer after my junior year, I had this idea to maybe like do an internship at another university. And I was looking at child development labs. And so I ended up taking an offer to do an internship at UC Berkeley, and I did developmental research, but with, children, obviously. And
did you work with, Gopnik?
I worked with a graduate student who was actually dual advised by, Fei Xu and Mahesh Srinivasan, Ruthie Fouché.
Cool.
She was lovely to work with.
Awesome.
And I think like that kind of spurred my interest in like early childhood development. And I think what was like really exciting and different, about early childhood research, at least like my initial experience with it, was it seemed like the graduate students had kind of like flexibility and autonomy with designing the studies in a way that I hadn't seen, before. And so I realize this, you know, now that I've designed my own studies and stuff, but, you know, designing studies to understand kids and then also making sure they understand you as well requires like a lot of creativity and to some extent ingenuity. And I hadn't been exposed to that before. And I think that was something I really liked about working in those labs. Yeah. And that kind of pulled me towards developmental research in early childhood.
It's so funny that I feel like that's such a common refrain. I wonder if we have like personality differences with developmental psychologists that are like, I don't know if that's personality, but just like very interested in like creative endeavors, because whenever we mm-hmm. talk about this, we're like, it was like this really creative problem to solve. Like, how
yep,
do you,
yep, yep.
you know, assess something yeah, yeah. in a child? It's like this common refrain that I think we hear a lot from people that end up going into child research. Because yeah, yeah, like, I mean, you know, we can give an older adult a survey, like ask them a question. But we're really having to find out, I love the way that you phrase that. It's like, how do we understand them and that they're understanding us. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a challenge.
For sure. That's actually exactly what got me into doing developmental work. So I started off with, doing research with infants. Actually, I still do research with infants. And even there, the problem is even more pronounced, right? Because babies don't speak, pre-verbal babies don't speak. And so you have to be quite clever mm-hmm. in your designs in order to be able to ask reasonable questions and in order to be able to get, like, you know, usable data. And so
now I'm there with you, Melis, though.
Is unique in that
I'm
regard.
There with Melis, though. I don't want to be quite that creative. So preschoolers
and above. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
No, I agree. There's like a happy medium.
Maybe there's a reason why I'm testing kids now. I become less creative.
See, you know what? Well, you just have to, you're just thinking of new questions. That's all.
Right.
Well, that's awesome. We're going to talk a little bit, I guess, too, about this is relevant to doing creative developmental research, right? This brings us to our
shit for doing research in general
our hot topic of the day. We wanted to chat with Melis a little bit about doing child development research during a pandemic, which doing any type of research during a pandemic is hard, and doing child development research on its own is hard. So put those two things together and you have like a very special scenario for something really difficult. So yeah, how's it been going for you, Melis?
It's actually been, it's been going really well. I actually have come to really love online testing kids. And so kind of like what happened was our lab's age range is like 4 to 11, right? And so before the pandemic hit, our lab relied heavily on elementary school testing, testing in children's museums and in lab testing. Those were the only ways we got kid data. And so then the pandemic happened and we didn't have any sort of infrastructure in place to do remote testing with kids. But one good thing is I feel like our methods for studying kids are pretty adaptable to an online format. With that being said, it wasn't, you know, particularly easy to get everything set up. Like, I think getting everything set up and getting the infrastructure in place was accompanied with a lot of growing pains. But now that we've figured it out and we've smoothed out the system, it's like really, really fruitful. And I feel like the kids are pretty engaged and like it. And the graduate students, the undergraduate RAs who help us test too, also enjoy it.
Sure. Now, are you testing primarily over Zoom?
We use Zoom.
Yeah, Zoom.
Gotcha. Have you all done any type of work yet? Or are you thinking about doing? So this is like when I was started looking into and making our plans for doing online data collection. It was like the first branch off is like, are you doing synchronous online testing of kids? Mm-hmm. Or are you trying to program and run like asynchronous studies? Are you all doing all synchronous work?
Yeah, we do all synchronous work. So it's really like we've just taken what we typically do in front of the kid and just like moved it to Zoom. So we are sharing our screens and we're reading them the things in the... We're reading them the stimuli as we usually would, like in the museum or in lab, and we ask them questions.
And it sounds like what's nice about your setup is that you have established databases of participants. And so it's not like you have to go above and beyond to recruit new participants. I'm sure you're pulling from existing databases. Perhaps I'm wrong, but maybe you can.
No, that's right. We have a baby database at NYU that's shared amongst a couple of labs. And so sure. We would usually use that to recruit in lab participants, but now we use it to recruit Zoom participants. And it's almost, I think it's been much more fruitful because people are just like more willing to hop on a computer and do something quick than to, you know, trek all the way down to NYU, because New York City is huge, and so it could really be a trek to NYU depending on where the parents and kids live.
Yeah. Are you all thinking about doing any type of like trying out the asynchronous world of like programming and letting a study run on its own?
We haven't had those conversations. We haven't had any conversations about that yet.
I'm trying to remember. I'm so terrible. I can't remember who it was. This was like probably like over a month ago or so. Somebody posted on Twitter and she was like, it's the weirdest time for research when my like adult MTurk study is taking forever, but yet I just collected like 80 participants in an asynchronous child study. Like,
I believe
roll it in because kids are home. And
maybe she would be willing to write a blog post sort of describing how she went about that process, because I would love to collect both, do both synchronous as well as asynchronous.
Yeah,
studies.
I think that they have their, you know, obviously pros and cons to both, as most things do. I've been trying to move us towards that, maybe for some like very simplistic studies. Like they would have to be, you know, something that's very, very straightforward and basic for the asynchronous studies. But I went through the same thing. I was like, oh boy, we didn't do anything online. Like we did face-to-face testing with kids, period. Like that was it. Either through daycares or, you know, other nonprofit partnerships or things like that, or through the school system.
I guess the question I would have to sort of, I guess what I would be wondering about is how to prevent, to control for things like learning effects. Like, I mean, would you build into the program like a certain number of attempts that they're allowed? I mean, you know,
for asynchronous studies.
For an asynchronous study. I mean, you of course would want to avoid, you know, learning effects. Yeah. Right. And so what do you do in that situation? I guess you just program it in.
Yeah, and I think that you would have like just like people do on MTurk or what's the other one? Oh, I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Qualtrics.
Yeah.
Well, Qualtrics is more for surveys.
There's another one.
Prolific.
Yeah, Prolific.
Prolific is another
big
one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They, you know, like having quality control sort of questions and checks and things like that. And I would imagine that that would be similar. But there are some people that have, I looked at one platform, the Lookit platform, and then I think childdiscoveries.org is the other one. Which was from Marjorie Rhodes, right?
Children helping science or something.
Children helping
that
science
was spearheaded by Elizabeth Bonowitz and a few other people.
Yeah, and Children Helping Science is just for advertising, so we use that.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure, Melis, if you all advertise too.
I think at one time we were considering it. I'm not sure if we like actually did that.
It's basically just a common website, and they have like their own social media and things where they will, you know, they have a form for you to fill out about your study, and then you can you submit that form, and then they'll get it posted up there. And so parents have a sort of one-stop shop to be able to click and say, you know, I'm looking for something for my three-year-old. I'm looking for something that's synchronous or asynchronous, and it'll give them a list of all the studies that their child might be able to participate in. So it's a great program that a bunch of different researchers were a part of putting that together. But yeah,
sure.
Children Helping Science, that's definitely one to check out. And it's pretty low stakes, and I'm pretty sure that we've gotten participants from there. Now, we've been... I want to ask Dion about his situation here in a second with his thoughts on starting up. I feel like we were all in very different places. Like, Melis, you're probably in a very well-established, if I can go ahead and just, like, assume to say that Andre's lab is well-established. I was in a precarious, like, this was only my second year as a faculty member here, so we were still, like, in the midst of establishing, especially because at a teaching focus institution, our research is really, we don't have time to get started until at least our second year, because our first year is so heavy on course prep. And now Dion is just starting a new job. So like all coming into this at different times.
Don't remind me. So what complicates my situation as well is that I do research both on kids and infants. Mm-hmm. Now, the research on kids, I intend on going about that the same way that I've been going about that this summer, which is to just collect participants online and then test them via Zoom. Mm-hmm. What for me is complicated matters a bit is how I intend on testing infants.
A little bit more challenging.
A little bit more challenging, right? To say the least.
Just a tiny bit.
You know, there are people like Jonathan Kominski and a few other people who are working on platforms and programs that make it easier to test infants in various designs. But there's no real true answer. And so for me, I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do when it comes to sort of my infant research. Yeah. It might just sort of be at a standstill for some time. But I'm hoping to, at some point, pick that kind of research back up. But in the meantime, I'm just testing kids over Zoom. Actually, this leads me to a question that I wanted to ask Melis. And the question I have for you is, as far as the stimuli are concerned, how did you go about this sort of stimuli situation? Did you create new videos online? Made animations? Did you just record actual in-person sessions and play those for participants? Like what?
Yeah, I think this happened kind of at like a good time in our lab, so to speak, because all of our stimuli was through Qualtrics. So we always administered studies to kids on a tablet through Qualtrics. And so like, it's very easy to just then do it on your computer and share your screen. But a few years ago, like when I started in the lab, we were doing everything on like laminated sheets of paper and showing kids physical stimuli. And that's not to say there weren't some challenges. Like I know some people in our lab do have physical stimuli, like they have like a little puzzle or something that they show kids. And so that required, you know, some problem solving. But for the most part, it was like in place to be like a remotely administered study, which was really nice.
We do everything with not in the past. In the past, very much like some other people's, we had like physical stimuli and storybooks and things like that. But we do everything in PowerPoint presentations.
That's actually, so before the pandemic, like most developmentalists, most of my stimuli, they were physical, right? And so once the pandemic hit, I had to figure out what I wanted to do, like how I wanted to go about, because I wanted to still do the studies, but of course, I wouldn't be able to use the physical stimuli. And so what I resorted to was PowerPoint. And so PowerPoint, believe it or not, is actually quite powerful and flexible. And so I was able to, make video two-dimensional versions of what I was actually doing in person. And what's nice about that too is you can test for effects of medium, right? And so what I intend on doing actually is once the data for these studies are collected, that's one of the analyses I intend on running, right? And the idea is that if there, hopefully there would be no effective stimuli, right? And what that would suggest is that it doesn't really matter the medium, at least for kids at a certain age, it doesn't matter the medium in which the experiment is presented, which is nice, just in case something like this happens again.
Or you want to
So
just
definitely
like keep
PowerPoint is.
collecting data online because like
Yep.
yeah, I mean, why not, right? I think that was like one
Yeah,
of
for
the, to
sure.
me, in within our field, like one of the positive things to come out of this is going to be saving people's time and resources to do
I
some.
think Melis hit it on the head, the nail on the head when she said that one of the nice features about online testing is that parents don't have to travel inordinate distances, right? You can do it from the comfort of your home. And when you have both options, both synchronous and asynchronous, it sort of makes it even better, even
And I think
sweeter,
that you'll end
right?
up
So
getting, or I won't say that, but what I hope is that you also might get some more diversity in the populations that seek out our studies. That, like, I mean, there's sort of inequities on both ends. So, like, people that might have access to technology and quality internet to do an online study, but then also, just people that it might be really not accessible for them to be able to drive somewhere and take time out of their day to go for a study in person, but might be able to do that if it was online. So
Absolutely.
that's my hope. I'm hoping that we're moving towards that. There is some interesting work though showing when I first started looking into this, that has preliminary work so far. I thought it was some of Marjorie Rhodes's work that's shown that there's not real a whole lot of differences that they found so far between online testing and face-to-face testing with at least
Surely it depends on the age,
with
'cause I mean, with
preschoolers. No, no,
infants, I
no,
mean,
no, no.
yeah, okay, with preschoolers,
Yeah, I'm not. I'm. I.
yeah.
Well, as Dion very well knows, I claim no expertise in infant research or anything related to anybody under the age
But
of
yet,
three.
three of our episodes have been on infants.
Good thing you were on those podcast episodes, because
No, you've had plenty of important things to say for
I
sure.
mean, yeah, interesting, maybe important things to say, and
Hey, they've instigated conversations, and I feel
that's what
like,
we hope to bring to the table is get people talking about things. So yeah, awesome. Well, I'm really excited to see what work is coming out of the pandemic for everybody and for you, Mela. So I look forward to reading about whatever your findings are from studies you all are working on now.
Yeah, same with you. I'm looking forward to hearing about your studies as well.
Indeed. So should we take a break and once we're done with the break, we'll come back and we'll talk about Melis's excellent study that was published in Child Development. Should we do
Yes,
that?
let's do that.
Great. All right, let's take a break. Welcome back. So, in this segment, we're going to talk about Melis's research that was published in child development. I was going to say cognitive development. And so, by way of introducing the research, I'll have Melis, if she would do it for me, have her discuss and describe the research, what motivated the research, what the main questions were, and we can go from there.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good. So whenever I explain this work, I usually start off by talking about really old work from the 70s, because our studies in this paper were based off some really classic work on kind of kids' achievement-related cognitions. And so there was kind of a series of studies in the 70s where researchers were interested in kids' representations of academic performance, specifically what do kids think are the sources of academic performance? And so they used this paradigm with kids maybe from like 5 to 13 years old, where they showed kids videos with two children in the video working side by side simultaneously on the same schoolwork. One of the children in the video works the whole time, and then the other child kind of works intermittently on and off. Sometimes they're looking at the window, sometimes they're working, sometimes they're playing with their pencil, whatever. And so at the end of the video, the kids are said to have earned the same score on the test. They both got a good score on the test. They got the exact same score. And so then experimenters would, ask participating children, did one of these characters work harder? Did they work the same? But the key question was always, one of these characters smarter, or sorry, is one of these children smarter, or is one of them the same? Or are they the same? Excuse me. And so what was really interesting, so like if you are asked that question as an adult, it seems like or there's a really obvious answer. It's super intuitive that the kid who worked less hard is smarter because they had to exert less effort to achieve the same outcome. That seems like really straightforward, intuitive to us. Given that the scores were the same, right? So you know their performance and you know their effort levels, and now you're inferring their intelligence or skill, whatever you want to call it. But young kids, typically before the age of like 9 or 10, did something kind of surprising, at least to researchers at that time. They would say the character who worked harder was smarter. And so, from a researcher's perspective, from an adult's perspective, that's kind of surprising.
Or even the wrong, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes, the wrong answer.
Right, definitely like the wrong answer. And even, it was even framed sometimes as like, an immature response. And like saying that the child who worked less hard was like the mature response.
Mature in the sense that because that response suggests an insensitivity to the parameters that you were mentioning that go into performance, right? Is that what it is?
Right, exactly. So it was thought that, these were immature responses because, okay, kids are, just they basically think like performance is effort, or they think like ability is effort. Like there's really no like differentiation of these concepts in the way that adults, very intuitively differentiate these concepts. And so, yeah, the upshot of this was like, younger children before the age of 9 or 10, they kind of have these immature, intuitions about ability, effort, performance, and things like that. And there was a lot of supporting evidence from kind of other paradigms and other research questions that suggested that, like, in the achievement domain, young kids are just like they're immature thinkers. Like, they're overly optimistic if they, like, fail in an achievement context. They're super resilient and hardy. And so there was just like a lot of converging evidence, I guess, for this characterization of young children as kind of like immature thinkers in this domain. Okay, so that was, the old studies. But
That's one
our
interpretation.
right.
Right. Right, because you have this other competing, you know, explanation, right, for what's going on.
Yeah, so what kind of motivated our study? So I talk about the kind of specifics of that study a lot because I think they're really important and they're what kind of inspired our studies. And so what kind of, what we were thinking about is like, well, you know, maybe there are some methodological things in the paradigm that are ambiguous to young children that create demands for young children. Because we kind of recently, like late 90s, early 2000s up to now, have, I think, more evidence pointing in the direction that young children have really rich conceptual representations, including in the achievement domain. So what's going on in these studies that they kind of give these, you know, supposedly immature responses? And so one of the things we were thinking about was, you know, maybe the way that the low effort child is conveyed, you know, expending low effort is ambiguous. You know, maybe it signals that they didn't like the task or they were having difficulty for the task. Like, is there a way we can convey low effort more clearly, more unambiguously?
Because I would say Mel is right. Like, it's not that, that's that format or that paradigm. It's really more about like time spent on the task, like what they did with that intermittent. But it's not necessarily clear that it took them less effort, right?
Right, there's that confound, and in fact, because the character is all over the place.
Right, like maybe, you know, they're, like, actually trying really hard intermittently, like, I feel like there's, what we take away from that, like you said, sort of as an adult, that it's like, oh, well, they just spent less time on it, so that meant they had to try less hard to do as well, but maybe something that children are inferring about that is not so much about, It could be something different. I think like time on the task and effort are also something that maybe we're thinking about as the same thing, but aren't always interpreted as the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And so I think those kinds of things that you're saying inspired us to kind of think carefully about ways of kind of more unambiguously conveying low effort. Yeah.
And if I may, I have one question before you get into the actual study. Now, do we know that the kids in these original studies were remembering that performance was equated between the two characters? Because I wonder if part of, you know, what's going on is them simply forgetting or not even paying attention to the fact that both characters, despite the fact they expended different amounts of effort, achieved the same score. And so perhaps some of that may be sort of explaining this sort of impoverished theory of performance. Maybe they're just simply not, they simply fail to recall or encode equivalent performance. I mean, were there manipulation checks to get at this, or do you not know?
I don't think there were manipulation checks. One thing that I vaguely remember is I think they kind of prompted kids before they started the video and kind of like prompted them with things to pay attention to, like, okay, I want you to think about, you know, if one of them worked harder or if they worked the same, and, you know, I want you to think about their scores or something. They might have said that, but there weren't like formal manipulation check.
Yeah, I was trying to remember too, because I know I obviously like Nichols and Miller's work with stuff that I looked at for my dissertation. I feel like at least somewhere along the way they would have asked a comprehension question, like,
exactly.
Did they perform, did they have the same score on the test or something like that? I would think that they would have, but I don't recall that specifically off the top of my head. I know that we've asked that before in work that I've done, which is not in the same context of that paradigm at all, but in more in relation to social comparison. But we do see that kids like of that age don't tend to have trouble recalling like their own and somebody else's performance that was given to them within that short of a period of time.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So this main issue that you're talking about still stands, though, which is the motivating the study, which is maybe the children were interpreting the intermittent performance in not the same way that the experimenter intended for them to interpret that performance. And in fact, maybe they were some sort of concluding based on this intermittency of the performance that this person sort of, which is incapable of the task or inept at the task.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's kind of a lot that's up for interpretation. And sometimes something I think about a lot too is like, you know, why would young kids evaluate a harder worker as smarter? You know, I think probably they, you know, are socialized to think at a very young age that like good behavior is, you know, signals like goodness in other dimensions, like in intelligence. And so, you know, thinking about what kids really, what dimensions they value when they answer those questions, I think is something that I thought about a lot too. But so, yeah, so our focus was kind of on the low effort character, right? And so one thing, we basically adopted Nichols' study almost exactly. And we just manipulated a couple of things, one of which was how we presented the low effort character. So instead, we had one condition where he works intermittently, just like in the Nichols study. But then we had another condition where he works quickly. And so we showed kids kind of like five frames, five drawings. And the number of frames where the low effort character is working is two. It's the same across conditions. It's just like, what is the arrangement of those? Is it intermittent, like in the classic study, or are they concentrated at the beginning, like in our study? And so one thing that we found is that when you manipulate this, for example, kids are more likely to, young kids specifically, 4 to 9 year old kids, which was like the age range with, you know, kind of questionable or like immature performance in those classic studies, they're more likely to pick the quote unquote low effort character as being smarter or more skilled. And so our framing for this study was like, well, you know, for a long time, researchers have kind of suggested that young kids' intuitive theories of academic performance rely only on effort. Like that's the only concept or ingredient that kids are thinking about when they evaluate academic performance. And so our study suggested to us, well, like if you kind of, you know, disambiguate a couple of things in the paradigm, kids seem to, you know, kind of bring in other concepts. So they are not just thinking about effort, they're also thinking about skill probably as well. And so that kind of suggested to us that there was maybe a mischaracterization of, you know, young children's achievement related concepts.
Can you sort of talk a little bit more about how exactly you sort of disambiguate it, sort of confound, as it were? How did you go about doing that?
So with the effort manipulation, like of having it all at once, so like watching this one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you have one other thing in the study, though, Melis, that I thought.
Like, I thought there was one other thing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, you guys read so closely.
No.
There was another manipulation, you're right. So we had one manipulation, which I described. The other manipulation that we thought about was, well, you know, in these classic studies, they show kids the videos, and then the first question they ask them is about, they ask them to appraise the characters' effort. So they say, you know, did one of them work harder or did they work the same? And so we thought, you know, potentially this could create some sort of task demand where, you know, you're asking this question first and then you're asking about the protagonist's skill levels or smartness levels. And so maybe by asking this question, you're suggesting to them that effort is a relevant dimension by which you should answer this second question about smartness. Our second manipulation was whether that effort question gets asked first before we ask kids to evaluate the skill levels of the protagonist, or maybe we can ask kids to kind of engage in thinking about the protagonist's mental states instead. And so the question in the other condition was, you know, did they think the test was easy to do or hard to do? That kind of gets them thinking about the protagonist's experience in the task and their mental states in the task. And maybe it kind of removes this effort-laden demand that was present in the classic study. And so we also found that when you ask kids about perceived difficulty, so how difficult the protagonist found the schoolwork or the exam, they are more likely to choose the low effort character as being more skilled or as being smarter.
Gotcha. And so what this suggests is that starting as early as 4 years of age, children, when you remove these task demands, so when you manipulate, for example, the order in which effort-based question or a skill-based question is asked, as well as when you sort of manipulate whether or not the character, the low-effort character, is engaging in low-effort intermittently or continuously, kids do seem to show sensitivity to, if we were to write an equation, for example, to the components that make up performance, the components being skill and effort. And perhaps the explanation then for the discrepancy in these views has to do, or sort of, concerns the nature of the task demands. Would that be an accurate characterization of the takeaway?
Yeah, I think that was a perfect takeaway. So that's exactly our thinking, right? So like maybe there was this characterization of kids thinking because of how the task was set up, and maybe all the components of the task aren't entirely clear to really young kids.
And I think that that's a it was such a clever, like, seemingly simplistic, one of those things that it looks so simplistic, like, oh, obviously wish somebody should have done this before, but it's mm-hmm. really a nuanced thing to notice, like, how that methodology in such a slight way can lead to very different responses in kids. And I thought one of the other cool things about your study was that it was like, especially when you disambiguated both of those mm-hmm. components,
yep.
that's when you saw the greatest shift in kids' responses to giving the opposite response that they would have given under Nichols' paradigm.
Right. It actually looked like from the data, it's like both of those components need to be present in order for kids to reason that way. So, you know, we had four conditions because we crossed two manipulations, each with two levels. And so it really seems like in that condition where both of these things are kind of disambiguated, that was the condition where kids were showing an intuitive theory in line with, we use this equation a lot, performance equals effort plus skill, rather than just performance equals effort.
And I was curious too, I know that this was, I might be jumping around in thoughts here, so I apologize too, feel free to correct me. Feel free. I think that this idea, when I was reading about even just that simple framing of the paper and like how kids conceptualize of performance, I was so curious because like it was so funny, like it makes so much sense. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, here's this way that I think about how kids conceptualize performance. Like they either conceptualize it as like effort-based or skill-based. Mm-hmm. And so to have this idea that it's one possible nuance is that they think of both of them. On the opposite mm-hmm. end is that they're reasoning just from effort. What I was curious was if you had, like, at any time thought, what about the opposite? Is there any time that kids are thinking about performance is just equal to skill? The reason why I think about that as a developmentalist is because I feel like so many times as an endpoint, and this is actually where I feel like Dion and I, when we started connecting about the topic of this podcast, and that's what I was interested in, is how kids think about ability and like, mm-hmm. is ability just something that we mm-hmm. have? And so
yep.
do you think that kids are getting to that point at some point where they, or is there any context in which kids, that's the salient response, is to think about performance as ability rather than, or skill, as you might be framing it in your paper. I always call it ability. But rather than, so like in your paper, it's like effort or effort plus skill. What about like just skill?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think something that I think about a lot that kind of speaks to this question is like, how much do kids kind of value each of these components? So in thinking about this paper more, I was thinking about, you know, like, if I ask you, okay, this person worked really hard and they're also very skilled, what do you think their performance is going to be like? You'd say hi. If I said this person is not skilled and they didn't work hard, you'd say their performance is going to be probably pretty low. And so what I'm kind of interested in is, well, what if we say, you know, person A is really skilled but doesn't put in much effort. Person B puts in a lot of effort but isn't really skilled.
This is exactly a question I had.
Yep. Like, do we think they would achieve the same performance? And I think that kind of speaks to, like, what we value. Like, do we value, you know, effort more or skill more? My intuition in this culture is that, like, people would say the person who is really skilled but didn't really try hard is going to achieve better performance. I think there's something very almost appealing about that combination in a weird way that signals that maybe we really like value skill as a source of academic performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, this actually relates, what you just said relates to a question I had, which is, you know, what would happen if you manipulate those dimensions, those components that make up, those parameters that make up a performance equation, what happens if you manipulate those independently? So just like you described, what if you have a character one, whose performance is high, but whose skill is high, but whose effort is low. You have another character whose effort is at the same level as the other person's skill, and their skill is at the same level as the other person's effort. Like, you know, are the kids going to infer the same level of performance? So if we could, let's add numbers to it. So for example, for character one, if we say character's one, his skill is at a level 10, whatever that means. And then his
come up with your creative solution effort. Now, Dion, first, and operationalize how we're going to convey to kids that one character's skill level is 10.
Well, you can do exactly what Melis was doing, which is manipulating the number of pages on which they work, right?
Well, and but
so
then that's one performance, way of, though, right? Like, is that the skill? That's supposed to be the outcome. And when we...
Well, no, I guess my question more importantly, though, is if it's possible, if there was a way to do
it. No, I agree. I totally agree with your idea. I'm just, the researcher in me is like, this is where we get into trouble because the devil is in the details of then how you convey it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But let's assume in my theoretical hypothetical world that you can somehow design your study where you can not only manipulate those parameters independently, but also... show that children are sensitive to the magnitude of those manipulations. So if, for example, if you can make it such that character one has a certain level of effort and a certain level of skill where skill is higher, and you have the second character whose effort is at the same level as character one's skill, are they going to infer the same level of performance? That's what you would, of course, think if they are using this more sophisticated theory or performance equals effort plus skill. Do we know, you know, is there any research that tries to manipulate these two dimensions independently, you know?
I can't think of anything right now, but yeah, like Candy was saying, I think it's really hard for like methodological reasons, but I think it's a super interesting question. And when I think about kind of just like giving, you know, IMTurkers or, you know, NYU undergraduates these kind of scenarios, I can kind of intuit what they might say. But yeah, conveying it to kids is more difficult, but I would be super interested in their intuitions about those.
I bring that up only because I think, you know, if one of the larger goals is to show that kids really do espouse this more sophisticated form of reasoning, I think it's important to show that their performance is consistent with the predictions in all directions of this particular equation.
Yeah.
So what you've shown, of course, is that they can reason about either component independently, but I think that equation, that theory makes other predictions, and again, the predictions it makes is if both parameters for both characters have the same value but in different directions, then the inference about performance should be equal.
Unless you have you have this like one equation is performance equals effort plus skill, mm-hmm. and they have their unweighted variables. Right. And then you have another equation, which is like performance equals effort plus two times skill or something. Right. And
it is complicated.
And I think that that's what you're
right.
saying, Melis, is like depending on what we value. And mm-hmm. I certainly think I don't know so much about children. I do think that as adults, we give more value to that. What I don't know what that is, but like the like smart person who doesn't have to work really hard because they're so super skilled, like we have some special value for that. And so, and I think that we might in our culture, at least in the United States, we have like we place a really high value on ability. And we know that from some cross-cultural research with like things like parenting and the weight that parents in some Western versus Eastern cultures place on effort in itself, and that we tend to overemphasize, at least they're even. So we tend to often encourage children in at a certain age in terms of effort and ability, or we say that we think that like our own child's effort and ability are both relevant to their performance, whereas in other cultures, parents will say much more that it's about their child's effort than about their ability. And so I think that would be really interesting to look at how that plays into and then is sort of transmitted to children and their own perceptions of performance.
Sure. It would be interesting.
One of the ways that I could try to see doing that methodologically, which was not for me to ding Dion on that, was like my own, like, it's so complicated, but one way is to use trait labels, right? Like that's one way that we denote ability for kids. And so you could pick out a very specific domain and convey trait language to kids. Like, okay, here's, you know, Johnny, and he is really athletic versus Jimmy, who is not athletic. And then you give them some indice, like maybe a Nichols study with like levels of effort towards a task, and then ask them to make predictions about performance. So
I guess my only concern with that approach, though, is that that's one way of doing it, but I would worry that they would over, or maybe their interpretation of not as skilled, they would place more weight on sort of that terminology than Johnny is skilled. And so you, I guess, would have to wonder if they're weighting both characteristics the same way.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was saying something more objective might achieve that by, for example, you have Johnny, if you're trying to convey skill, you would introduce the kid to a context where Johnny's playing basketball, for example, and he shoots 10 free throws and he makes all 10 free throws. Like that seems like a very clear way of communicating skill.
But it's not, though, it's performance, right?
Or whatever. Yeah, performance, right.
We want to try and get at, made him shoot 10 baskets, is it because he inherently has some ability to do something really well, or is it that he's put in a lot of effort, and that's where it gets so complicated? Because as adults, again, here's the creativity.
Yeah.
As adults, we can just say that. We have the word ability, or we could say inherent skill, right? We could describe that to an adult and say, and we ask them that. How much of my ability to write a paper is due to my innate capacities to write versus how much of it is due to my effort and how much I try to write a paper?
Sure.
And adults can talk about that. And for kids, I feel like the closest we've come to it is providing trait language, because children do understand from a relatively early age, as Melis, as you mentioned in your paper, and in some of the work that we talked about with my former grad advisor, Janet Boziewski. Like, kids at a young age can reason about traits, sometimes in limited capacities, but especially if you give them a trait label, and they do tend to essentialize traits. They see them as things that are part of our essence or being, and they use those to make predictions about the future.
Sure.
So they get that, and they see that as some type of skill or ability. And so if we were... I don't know. I feel like this hasn't already been done, because if it has, like, I feel like I would have already read this paper, and maybe I just don't remember it. But I think this is a cool idea to look at matching, having these cross conditions for trait labels. It's not always going to be the same, because to your point, Dion, is saying athletic and not athletic.
Are they given the same weight in the way we intend
Probably
for them
not.
To be given
You can
the weight,
pretest.
Right?
Not athletic, no. Not athletic, not smart. Those things seem like more damning to me. Like they are deficient.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly why. That was exactly my point.
It's easier when you're doing, if you were doing it in relation to personality traits, because for kids, like outgoing versus shy tend to be rated like more similarly in the extremes. But yeah, like when we say, if you say to a kid, like somebody's not smart, that means something very serious.
They're like, this dude is an ignoramus and oh my God, his outcomes in life are dismal.
Right. And like, why do you think that is?
Right.
Like, why is that so serious to like a 5-year-old to call somebody not smart?
Well, I mean, there's probably lots of explanations, but I can see one explanation having to do with the kinds of reinforcement they receive in the real world. Right?
Yeah.
If you're constantly being reinforced for, expending lots of effort or having, intrinsic skill, not being told that is quite damning.
Yeah, we're like, how,
right? Quite damaging.
How often, Melis, do you go around calling 5-year-olds not smart little kids?
Yeah, never. Yeah, but these are sorts of things or concerns, I think, that come up in my mind when I'm designing studies, because I think a lot of my work, I ask kids to judge characters' smartness, or why this one's smart, why this one is not smart, why this one is performing well, why is this one not performing well. And this is always a concern of mine, is I think that, you know, calling someone, these seem like fairly innocuous questions from my perspective, but I think kids have like remarkable social desirability concerns, which kind of prompt them to kind of monitor and modify their responses. And, you know, it's kind of difficult, I guess I should say, to kind of ask kids these questions sometimes for these reasons that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, that's always an issue that I don't know. One of my questions for you, and I think we've already talked about this some, about like the validity or the quality, I guess, maybe, of like our methods that we have to assess kids' understandings of things, like their intuitive theories about performance.
So yeah, most of my research
solve it for
uses...
us right now, Bellis.
I cannot. Good. I cannot. But yeah, most of my studies use this paradigm, where like a storytelling paradigm, and so I kind of carefully design stimuli, and then I question kids about the stimuli in kind of like a hypothesis testing way. And so the thing I find myself concerned about a lot, I mean, among a few things, but one of them is this like social desirability thing. And so it's on the one hand, it's interesting to me because it's almost remarkable that young kids are attuned to these concerns, like that they monitor or modify their responses at all. And actually, Gail Heyman gave a talk one year at SRCD that I thought was so beautiful, where she almost convinced me that like social desirability concerns are like an amazing developmental phenomenon and not, you know, like less of a methodological concern and more of this like amazing developmental phenomenon, which I think is true. But yeah, it's definitely like a concern in all my studies, in addition to, you know, the validity points you raise.
I actually, if I may, I actually have a validity question. So you in the study, now this is a bit in the weeds, so feel free to tell me to shut the hell up. But in the study, you measure this sort of construct of skill by asking the kid directly, who's smarter? And so the question I have is, do we know, like, to me, it wasn't immediately clear why, you know, what the relationship between one's level of smartness and one's skill is. And I guess the more important question to me is, and this is about sort of like convergent validity, you know, if we use this measure that is asking kids about smartness as a proxy for skill, does, you know, their responses correlate with other measures that actually do a better job at, or not a better job, but that sort of evaluate skill differently? Mm-hmm. If there is a correlation, of course, then you would have reason to believe that you are in fact asking them about to evaluate smartness, they are in fact showing some level of sensitivity to skill. And so I sort of wanted to get your sort of thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is a limitation that we thought about. You know, we do ask kids, do you think one of them is smarter? Do you think they're the same? And yeah, smart is probably not the same thing as skilled. At least, like, I kind of confound the two, and we've been playing it fast and loose, even talking here about like ability, skill, smartness. And so I think a lot of those things are kind of confounded or kind of mixed up. But yeah, one thing that I thought would have been nice in that study was, you know, to ask a more like skill focused question, like who is better at this? That seems to approximate skill better to me. One of the reasons we asked,
or have multiple operationalizations of skill, right?
Right.
And examine to what extent, you know, responses on these operationalizations correlate. And then you would have a better idea of whether or not your intention is in fact getting at, I mean, whether or not their responses are in fact a response that's attuned to skill and not something that's correlated with skill but may not be skill.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, part of the reason we did smartness is because we were so...
You're really sticking with that paradigm.
Exactly. Yeah. You're really trying to stick with that paradigm.
And I would say, too, that, like, there is, you know, in terms of the relatedness between children's different types of skill judgments, like, so in our work, for example, we ask things like about a trait and like smartness, but then we might also ask a question about like, you know, is this child also good at, if there was a specific task they were doing, like these types of tasks or games or whatever it is. So that's maybe more like a skill without using a trait word. And kids like also can distinguish between by this age, like relevant and irrelevant traits. So smartness is probably the most ambiguous because like we could think about as adults, like being smart is related to a whole lot of things. And kids probably do the same, but like academics, they see that trait term of smart being relevant to an academic task. And I think in the Nichols paradigm, I think that's pretty clear that they're doing an academic task. And they would distinguish that between, like, if you told a child of this age that, like, the one of the characters is athletic, they wouldn't necessarily assume that they would also be good at an academic task because they can distinguish the generalizability of traits. Now, they don't do that as well for positive traits as they do for negative traits, but that's a whole other episode.
It was just a minor, sort of minor question, and I think the more important point is that, like, when you make the conditions as similar as they can be to the original Nichols study, you get precisely what they find. But then when you disambiguate these factors that clearly affect their evaluation and performance, you see more sophisticated reasoning. And I think that the mere fact that you replicated,
I was going to say, can we just give snaps for a second for replication?
Exactly, because if you didn't replicate, the point is that if you didn't replicate, of course, but showed this finding, then it's hard to, it's not clear what inferences can be made. So I think replication was key. So yeah, definitely snap for that one.
Thank you. I was really excited about that too, actually. And lots of people have used his paradigm and actually replicated his results.
But you always think you might be the one that doesn't.
Sure. Right. But also,
well, these are kids. They're fickle.
Of course. And this study was done in, you know, probably early to mid 70s. And so it's like, we spend a lot of time kind of criticizing this study, but I secretly really love this study just because it's so simple. And it has its problems and we point that out, but it's very simple. It's super robust, replicable.
And it's clearly getting at something important.
Yeah. Right. It's showing developmental change. The interpretations of it are pretty clear. All that is to say we spend some time criticizing, and I think there's some problems with it, but it's also like a really cool study, I think.
Exactly.
So, and the changes that you see then, so like if you were looking at the Nichols study, you see this developmental progression that everybody thought was like, the developmental progression, like this is how it goes. But you were able to show under these different conditions that like you can show that, if we want to call it more mature responding, whatever, at an earlier period. So what do you think is, like, for lack of a better word, like what's the mechanism there that then is, you know, outside of just making the task more simplistic, then what is leading to these theories of children's like intuitive theories about performance? What sort of things do you think are feeding into that? Or like, if we could, let me say this a different way. If we could disambiguate this task even farther, like when do you think these theories sort of start, and what lends themselves to these theories?
Well, so I'm clear. You're not, like, one of the takeaways from your paper is in fact that there is no theory change. That at least given your sample, they seem to show evidence that they're evaluating performance in a sophisticated way, right? Yes. So she's not showing, I take your question, Candy, to be what's your mechanistic explanation of them going from theory change to what she's showing, but what she's
That's not my question. Sorry, let me clarify. That was before the proposition is that there's a change, right? And so there have been mechanisms purported for that. So, like, I guess one question is, do you think that the same mechanisms are at play regardless of you showing this earlier on? And then if you could, like, make this task more simplistic or reduce any demands further, like, Like, do you think that this really is how young kids are just immediately thinking about performance as in a this effort plus skill way pretty early on? Would you think you could show it earlier? And just sort of, I guess that's probably multiple questions all in one, so I'm sorry. Answer whatever
answer
part.
Answer all 100 of those questions.
You feel like answering all that question.
Yeah, no pressure. No, so what's interesting is that I had a hard time getting Nichols, who kind of was responsible for this paradigm and that kind of theory about kids thinking. I had a hard time like getting a clear grasp at like what he thinks the mechanisms for those changes are. I've never really seen, maybe I missed it, but I never really saw a clear explanation. But if I'm thinking kind of broadly about like, well, how do kids like from, you know, nothing, how do they come up with these theories and how do they incorporate these concepts into their theories at all? And so what I think might be happening, this is kind of like an amorphous blob of an idea, but I think young kids, you know, even before four, around four, whatever, I think they're really attuned to differences in competence and differences in outcomes. And so they're spending a lot of time through really like quotidian, mundane experiences, kind of evaluating what they can do, what their mom can do, what dad can do, whatever. And so I think they also learn from their own experiences too, right? So like, if I try harder at this, I can get the desired result or I'm better at this, but you know, maybe that's not the case for all things. And so I think they, you know, are thinking about performance, they're thinking about outcomes, they're kind of attuned to differences in competence, if you will, and they started, or differences in outcomes, and you know, they can kind of start to think, well, maybe effort or like trying, whatever kids' representation of effort is when they're like two or three, I'm sure they have some, you know, kind of rough representation of what that is. Well, maybe that is relevant for outcomes. And then, you know, later on, well, that's not the only thing that's relevant. And then other concepts that don't seem relevant at all, like, I don't know, niceness or whatever, don't seem, start to, you know, kind of fall out as candidate concepts that seem relevant. Right. And then I think, you know, like schooling matters a lot too. I think that brings a lot of things into sharp focus when kids start school around, you know, three, four, five. And that probably makes the skill component come into sharp focus as well, I think.
This is your the first part of the mechanistic explanation for me. Well, both parts are very interesting. For me, the first part about sort of the frequency with which they're evaluating each component based on their real world experience is interesting because it makes a lot of interesting predictions. One of which, of course, is that unlearning these inferences should be quite difficult, right? So if you were to bring a kid in and have them unlearn or learn the exact opposite of what their real world experience is like, you know, they should find it much more difficult to do that. And that would be quite consistent with the explanation that you sort of lay out here. Now, doing that, of course, is not really clear how you would go about doing this, but that's sort of one way of really getting at this sort of, at least the first part of your mechanism. And I certainly agree, having never done this research about, you know, I think probably there is a bit of sort of an effective education going on too, and the nature and the dynamics of you know, traditional classrooms that may be contributing to a full-fledged understanding of both components of the mechanism. And then thirdly, and I'll shut up, I think a third part that's really interesting about your mechanistic explanation is that it doesn't deny development. In fact, your mechanistic explanation is in fact developmental, right? It suggests that this happens, this sensitivity to the components of the equation emerge based on assessments in the real world and based on education. And I really, really like that component, because you are seeing, like, yeah, in your study, you show that there's some performance, you know, starting at 5 years of age and even younger, like there is, you know, they do seem to be reasoning in this more sophisticated way, but there's still, looking at your figures, still seems to be some development even within this group. And so I like your explanation because it really maps onto your own data. And it's very much consistent with my own experience.
Yeah,
so.
And there's kudos. Yeah. Still a ways to go. with these, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Melis. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think so our, you know, kind of the upshot of our paper kind of could come off as like, you know, the theory change idea was totally wrong, but, you know, we did have to manipulate these things in order for kids, for young kids to get these sorts of responses. And then, you know,
Candy, this is the robustness stuff we were talking about.
Yeah, the robustness stuff is, I think it's a really good point. Like, we had to manipulate these things in order for kids to respond this way. And when we don't manipulate these things, they respond in a different way. So what does that suggest? And
what does that mean?
It just shows that it's tenuous. It's tenuous.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that what I hope the paper made clear is that, like, there's more continuity in, like, the access to these concepts. And then, you know, what kids kind of by default pull on when they're reasoning about academic performance, like there might be a lot of age-related differences. And it seems like there might be age-related differences. So the defaults could be different, but kind of the access or like the repertoires.
Yeah, I think there's this very important but seemingly subtle sometimes in the way we talk about it distinction between what children are capable of and what they tend to do when presented mm-hmm. with some situation or context that's relevant. So like in the moment when a kid is in a classroom and they don't do well on something, are they going to say like, well, this is because I really should have tried harder and next time I'll just put in more effort because it's not just my skill, it's also my effort. No, in that moment they might think like, I'm just like completely incompetent or whatever, or vice versa if it's a positive scenario. But that doesn't mean that that's the only way that they can think about performance. Like they can, as an adult, a full functioning, hopefully adult, where I recognize that both my skills or abilities and my effort are important. Oftentimes as adults, we could still neglect considering one or the other in any particular mm-hmm. context. So I really like that that's part of the work that you're doing is to try and distinguish those things, which I think have gone relatively uncontested for a long time, that like if kids respond in a particular way, that just means they're incapable of thinking about mm-hmm. performance or abilities in a different way. And so I really appreciated that in this paper. One of the other findings, if I might point out, that I like found really was like in line with basically almost all of the work that I've done is where you had this sort of like kids rating of skills and the finding was dependent upon whether you asked about this is so they're rating this character's skill you know as somewhere between like not smart and all the way up to smart, and that it depended on who you asked them about first. Like, if you ask them about the character that put in more effort or the character that put in less effort. So I thought that added another dimension of saying, like, my even calibration on a scale of how smart I say you are depends on if I have, you've asked me first or shown me first this other person that had some other level of effort. It's like when we show the characters in isolation rather than together. I think it's just, again, it's like thinking about, okay, then what happens when I'm in a classroom and I'm like, there's like 10 mm-hmm. other kids around that are putting in various levels of effort, and am I thinking about them one at a time or thinking about them together? And that really,
yeah,
it really impacts my response. It's sort of like these contrast effects, right? Where like, if you tell me about like the kid that put in, more effort, we should say like that they are technically like lower on that scale, but that we only see that when you presented me with that character second mm-hmm. and I have some sort of where to go on that.
We were in, I feel so like silly for not even like thinking of this order effect, because like after it happens it's like, oh, that totally makes sense. Like if I ask you, you know, to judge two people's smartness and I'm presenting them sequentially and I say, this person really worked really hard, they got an A+, how smart do you think they are? You'd be like, they're really smart, they got an A+. And then if I said, this person didn't work that hard and they got an A+, you'd be like, oh yeah, they're also really smart. But when you do it in the reverse order, you get this contrast effect where they're like, oh, the person who put in less effort, that's the smarter one. So this order effect seems totally reasonable to me.
Yeah, but it's like we don't, and I know that there's work with, there's a sort of classic contrast and trait in the trait literature is like taking really extreme examples, like, how nice do I think Dion is? Well, like, okay, I think he's at least above the midpoint on nice. I'm like, okay, now, like, compared to, you know,
Melis, who's off the charts, nice.
Compared to Melis, like, okay, no, like, Dion's going to go down now because I have this contrast effect, and Melis is so much nicer. No, but, like, really, the severe, like, extremes is, like, literally...
Compare me to her in any dimension, and she'll always be out.
For, you know, adults, with, they'd give scenarios like comparing somebody to Hitler, comparing you to Mary Poppins, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden... even as adults, it like so severely shifts our perceptions of others, which makes sense. And so I don't think that we've looked at that too much in the...
Although, so I will say, this may be related or not related to what you were saying. What I really liked about this study is that, because you have the separate measure where you look at their espousal of the Carol Dweck dimension.
Growth
like,
mindset.
What is it? Yeah, growth mindset, right. And you show that there is no correlation, right? And so, because of course, one explanation for performance is, oh, they just have, you know, kids with different mindsets are going to interpret the data differently. But what you show is that there is no correlation. So that explanation probably is not sort of at play. I really like that aspect of this study.
Yeah. I could kind of see it going either way too. So I don't know if I'm surprised one way or the other. I could definitely. So what we asked kids in one of the studies in study one was, do you think anybody could be really smart at school? Or are there some kids who could never be smart at school? And so that's kind of like approximating, you know, mindsets about scholastic performance or intelligence, smartness, whatever. And kids' responses to that didn't correlate with their responses to the other more kind of paradigm contingent questions that we asked them. Which was interesting. I think that suggests that, to us, that suggested, you know, these were kind of tapping kind of like basic representations, but then like kind of your beliefs about what those concepts are like, how malleable those concepts are, that's kind of like a separate thing.
Yeah, I think it's like, again, what children think is possible versus evaluating the evidence that I've seen in front of me seem to be like two separate components. But that's, I was glad that you included it, because that could be one way that people respond to this, is just to say like, oh, well, if I just always think that anybody's capable of anything with effort, then... skills are relevant to the equation and we don't have to talk about that. And so I like that. Your explanation made complete sense. I was a little surprised at first that it wasn't related. And I was like, oh, I could see it. I was sort of my assumption as I was reading through the method. I was like, well, this is clearly going to be connected here. And then I was like, nope, not at all.
The thing that was surprising to me about that question was that there was a relationship with age in a way that was like kind of surprising to me and kind of in opposition with like the characterization of young kids as like super optimistic. And so we found that younger kids were more likely to say like, not everyone can be smart at school. And older kids were more likely to say, yeah, everyone can be smart at school. And so I think that's interesting and, like, surprising. It also, like, brings in concerns about social desirability, as it usually does. But, yeah, that was surprising to me.
Yeah, I was surprised there, too. That was my thought, was, like, oh, are these, like, older kids just saying, like, oh, I should probably not say that about other people, that some people just can't be smart at school. But, I mean, you said that was Susan Gelman's presentation about self-presentation.
Gail Heyman.
Oh, Gail Heyman, yeah. I think that that's a... such a, I wish that I was at that talk, because I think that that's such a true point. It's like, sometimes we're like, oh no, they're just like engaging in self-presentation. That's like, but you know what? A lot of life is engaging in self-presentation in a very important way. Like, that is a really positive skill. So
yeah. And to some extent, a really sophisticated skill that you might not expect kids to be, to engage in.
And an empathetic skill, so from a sort of social and emotional and relationships perspective. Well, I feel like we have just, like, taken you through your paces of talking about this study. It's been...
We did a deep dive.
That's just a testament to just doing a good study, doing a great study.
It's super interesting.
So yeah,
it was really great to read it and think about in relation to the work that I do and stuff that I hope to do in the future. And just thinking about, I think especially these methods and thinking about even how I conceptualize methodology in my own studies. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me and inviting me to think about these questions too.
We're not allowed to let you leave the podcast until...
Yeah, you're not the ringer quite
until
yet.
We ask... Oh, dear. Are we at our signature question? Can I ask it? Or did you have anything else, Dion? Okay.
No, I've exhausted all my questions.
Okay. Our question that we have asked all of our guests so far as a fun way to end the episode is that if you were not in the field of developmental psychology, what do you imagine that you would be doing for a career right now?
Oh, yes. That's a good question.
She's like, oh, no.
It's a difficult one for sure. You're so steeped in what you do, it's hard to think of a counterfactual. Yeah. Yeah. This wasn't the case.
Yeah. Let me think. What I...
She's like, I have so many damn options.
something I was like thinking about the other day that I would like to be doing is, like, during the pandemic, I've been like frequenting bookstores and plant stores, and I was like, how lovely would it be to own a plant shop or a bookstore, and then you could spend your day interacting with crazy plant people or bookworms? That would be really lovely. I'm probably naively overlooking like how complicated that job is. And
well, you haven't worked on that part of the equation yet.
I really haven't.
You gotta still build that. You gotta still build that equation muscle. That parameter muscle.
I don't have the theory.
No. That's such a fun one. I got into gardening during the pandemic, so which I feel like that's almost a requirement for most people. So I agree. I can see that. That would be pretty cool to be in a plant shop or just a bookshop, just read. And, you know, you should have had in your alternate reality that I'm constructing for you, you would have a combo plant and bookshop. Where people
that would be lovely.
Get their book
and throw coffee in there too, but I can't make coffee.
Now you're
retirement with, plans. Well, thank you again so much, Melis. We really appreciate it. You've been an awesome guest. We love having you on the show. Please come back anytime.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for talking us through the paper and you know, for doing cool research and yeah, I look forward to seeing what you have in store and to having you on the podcast, because like I was saying off air, I think you should become the amicus podcast friend of the podcast. I don't really know what the term is.
It would be an honor, my pleasure.